content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the October 24th, 2025 issue of the Week. On our cover drawing this week, we see a young man. He's pale, has closely cropped hair. He looks a little bit gaunt. He's facing us, and he's in a warm embrace, holding on to a young woman who's got her back to us. He's smiling, and the woman's T-shirt is the flag of Israel. We can see that. The headline is Home at Last, After the Release of Israeli Hostages, Can an Enduring Peace Be Secured in Gaza? That is our first main story. We'll start with that. Trump declares peace as Gaza ceasefire takes hold. What happened? A triumphant President Trump this week celebrated a hard-won ceasefire in Gaza that secured the release of all remaining hostages held by Hamas, even as doubts remain that peace between Israel and the Palestinian terrorist group would last. In Tel Aviv, more than 100,000 people crowded into Hostage Square to watch a telecast of the arrival of the last 20 of the 251 people Hamas kidnapped on October 7, 2023. Those released included Aviatar David, 24, forced to dig his own grave for Hamas propaganda, and Avinatan Or, 32, whose girlfriend, hostage Neo Agamani, was rescued by Israeli soldiers last year. At last, Agamani said, we can begin our healing together. In the West Bank and Gaza, Palestinian families welcomed the return of nearly 2,000 detainees, including five children. But it was a grim homecoming to a land pounded and rubble by 2 years of Israeli bombing. He came out of one small prison to a bigger one, said Gazan resident Rozan Nadif Adwa of her newly released fiancé. A devastated prison. Trump's victory lap included visits to Israel and Egypt, addressing the Israeli Knesset, where some lawmakers wore red hats reading Trump the Peace President. He said this was the historic dawn of a new Middle East. Israel has won all that they can by force, he said, and should translate those victories into a new era of peace. He also called for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to be pardoned on corruption charges. Later, Trump had stronger words for Hamas, saying if the group failed to fully disarm, we will disarm them, and perhaps violently. On the ground, Hamas militants publicly executed dozens of Palestinians it deemed threats to its power, attempting to assert control before a planned international stabilization force arrives. And while Hamas was supposed to give back the bodies of 28 hostages who died or were killed in captivity, it handed over the remains of just a few, saying it needed more time. Israel responded by halving the amount of aid newly flowing into Gaza. That was a blow for the enclave's 2 million citizens, most of whom are hungry and displaced, because about 80% of Gaza's buildings are damaged or destroyed. The level of needs, the level of starvation, the level of misery and despair will require a massive collective effort, said UN Humanitarian Chief Tom Fletcher. What the editorial said, President Trump can fairly claim a generational accomplishment in ending the worst conflict between Israelis and Palestinians in decades, said the Washington Post. Now the immediate priorities will be surging humanitarian aid into Gaza and standing up a functioning Palestinian administration. Following the full roadmap of Trump's 20-point peace plan will be an arduous process that will demand continued leadership. Trump's genius lay in ignoring global cries for an immediate peace, said the Wall Street Journal. Former President Joe Biden had pressured Israel to stop fighting before Hamas was defeated, But Trump backed Netanyahu as Israel smashed regional U.S. adversaries, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, Iran's proxies in Syria. He knew that Israel's soldiers first had to win the war to secure these favorable terms for the hostages' release. What the columnist said. This was indeed a triumph for the Israeli military, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. Back in 2023, many in Hamas thought October 7th would succeed not just in wounding Israel, but in destroying it. That included the attack's bloodthirsty mastermind, Yahya Sinwar. Now Sinwar is dead, and Israeli military and intelligence victories have changed the game with Lebanon and Syria and humiliated and defanged Iran. But it's also a win for Trump's hyperactive transactional approach to diplomacy, said Rich Lowry in National Review. Trump's unwillingness to take no for an answer, whether from Netanyahu, Hamas, or the Arab states he corralled into helping mediate, paid off spectacularly. Diplomats tend to say you can best achieve things by making others feel it was their idea. Trump shows, to the contrary, that sometimes there is no limit to the good you can do if you want all the credit. And so, those who have plied Israel with weaponry get to crown themselves peacemakers, said Nasreen Malik in The Guardian. Palestinians are returning to their homes in Gaza City to find a wasteland flattened to the horizon. As they unearth bodies in the rubble, the death toll of 67,000 will certainly rise. And occupying Israeli troops haven't even left yet. They've only withdrawn to the so-called Yellow Line, where this week they gunned down five Palestinians who tried to cross. We can't pretend the U.S. is an honest broker for peace, any more than we can return to the pretense that Palestinian life is viable under the authority of Israel. Not after this. That's the problem with Trump's peace deal. It puts off the hardest question, said Joshua Keating in Vox. Prioritizing the ceasefire and hostage release was probably the right approach. Otherwise, Israel and Hamas would still be haggling over every little detail while the fighting continued. Yet to be determined, though, is when Hamas will fully disarm, when Israel will fully withdraw, and who will govern Gaza. It's not difficult to imagine a range of scenarios that could lead to the war resuming, and Netanyahu seems ready for that to happen. Everywhere we fought, we won, Netanyahu said this week. But the campaign is not over. The controversy of the week, Trump. Can he shape reality in Portland and Chicago? President Trump's self-declared war on the enemy within keeps running into the same problem, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. The enemy's stubborn refusal to exist. Federal Judge April Perry last week issued a temporary restraining order blocking Trump's deployment of federalized National Guard troops to Chicago, ruling that his claims of widespread rioting and rebellion were unreliable and cannot be aligned with facts on the ground. That echoed a ruling made days earlier by Judge Karen Emmergut, a Trump appointee who blocked the president from sending guards to Portland, Oregon, calling his depictions of a war-ravaged city simply untethered to the facts. While there have been daily protests outside an ICE facility in downtown Portland, the rallies have been overwhelmingly peaceful, with many demonstrators wearing inflatable animal costumes. But never known for its fealty to facts, Trump doubled down, claiming Portland was so riot-torn it doesn't even have stores anymore. It will take the Supreme Court ultimately to decide whether Trump has unfettered power to send U.S. troops to U.S. cities, said Alexei Kosoff in the San Francisco Chronicle. That will mean tackling thorny issues of state sovereignty and the even weightier question of who gets to determine reality. Reality is reality, said David French in the New York Times, and it constrains all of us, even presidents. Trump and his outraged defenders argue that no previous president has been blocked from deploying the National Guard and that Trump is entitled to the same judicial deference. But previous presidents were responding to actual breakdowns in law and order, such as Southern states' refusal to integrate schools in the 1960s and the Los Angeles riots of 1992. Trump, by contrast, is just making things up, using wildly false statements to exercise military force in democratic states and cities. A president who constantly lies deserves no deference at all. There's nothing made up about the violence in Chicago, said Julie Bozeman in the New York Times, but it's caused by federal agents. ICE and the Border Patrol have drastically ramped up the intensity of their immigration raids in recent weeks and are now routinely using smoke bombs, tear gas, and pepper balls against residents who protest the arrest of their undocumented neighbors. U.S. citizens are being stopped on the street, thrown to the ground, and detained by agents despite having committed no obvious offense. Meanwhile, at the White House, Trump last week chaired an Antifa roundtable where MAGA influencers showed off injuries they claim were inflicted by leftist protesters in Portland, said Makena Kelly in Wired. ICE and these content creators are engaged in the same project, manufacturing visual proof to substantiate Trump's bogus claims of urban disorder, giving him cause to send in troops. The war on Antifa is both buffoonish and sinister, said Paul Waldman in MSNBC.com. Buffoonish because Antifa doesn't actually exist, and it's just a grandiose label claimed by anarchists and troublemakers. But sinister because that nebulousness makes the term infinitely flexible. Trump's plan is to label all and any political dissent Antifa and deploy resources to crush it, said Jonathan B. Last in The Bulwark. Whether those resources include the National Guard is up to the courts. But Trump knows that if he can link the idea of Antifa and terrorism in the minds of the public, then he will have laid the predicate, should he need it in next year's midterms, for the massed arrests of dissenters, or of anyone he wants. Good week, bad week. It was a good week for forbidden fruit, after scientists found that internet users are more likely to click on content if it's flagged with trigger warnings about potentially upsetting or offensive material. Negative or disturbing information, said researcher Victoria Bridgeland, tends to stand out and feel more valuable. It's a good week for assessments. After President Trump offered quick-fire takes on fellow leaders as they posed for photos at the Gaza summit in Egypt, including UAE Veep Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed Al Nahyan, quote, bundles of cash, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, quote, beautiful, and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, quote, a tough person who wants to be left alone. It's a good week for exclusivity after the Kenyan Catholic Church introduced a new brand of altar wine for Holy Mass. Unfortunately, the former wine is readily available in secular outlets and bars, said Archbishop Anthony Muheria. The newly approved wine is not for sale at any business. But it was a bad week for angles after President Trump blasted Time magazine for using a super bad photo of him as its cover image. The photo was shot from below against a bright sky, foregrounding the loose skin of Trump's neck and making his wisp of hair appear translucent. They disappeared my hair, Trump posted. Really weird. It was a bad week for sitting back after Canadian airline WestJet announced plans to start charging passengers for the privilege of reclining seats. Such seats will be available only in premium and extended comfort class, said WestJet, while economy customers will enjoy a new fixed recline seat. Finally, it was a bad week for the scientific method after Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said during a cabinet meeting that while there is no hard proof that Tylenol use in pregnancy causes autism, as he and Trump claimed last month, we're now doing the studies to make the proof. And in other news, Qatari airbase plan sparks MAGA backlash. The Trump administration is facing blowback from MAGA world allies after promising Qatar a facility within a U.S. Air Force base. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth last week announced plans for a Qatar Emiri Air Force Base facility at Idaho's Mountain Home Air Force Base to be paid for by the Arab nation. Qatar will use the facility to train pilots to fly F-15 jets it's buying from the U.S. The base will remain under American jurisdiction, but high-profile MAGA figures were infuriated. Former Trump strategist Steve Bannon said, "There should never be a military base of a foreign power on the sacred soil of America." Social media influencer and frequent Trump confidant Laura Loomer posted, "Never thought I'd see Republicans give terror-financing Muslims from Qatar a military base on U.S. soil so they can murder Americans." Vice President J.D. Vance defended Hegseth, calling the uproar a fake story. Moving over to the briefing, title this week, Ready for the Apocalypse. As anxiety rises about the state of the world, the ranks of preppers are growing and changing. What exactly is a prepper? It's anyone who anticipates a calamity resulting in some degree of social collapse and makes a plan or prepares to survive independently. Behind that definition lies a gamut that runs from suburbanites with bug-out bags to survivalists with basements full of firearms, spam, and canned beans, to tech moguls investing in underground bunkers with spa suites. They're driven by fears of weather catastrophes, nuclear strikes, civil war, mass disease, the coming of biblical end times, and anything else that might force citizens to fend for themselves. John Ramey, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and founder of The Prepared, a rational website that offers guidance on such matters as bug-out bag essentials, first aid kits, lifeboat rations, and the best body armor and survival knives, says only one thing links today's preppers. They're people who are smart enough to be aware of what the world is like and had the gumption to do something about it. How many preppers are there? More than 20 million. That's according to Chris Ellis, a U.S. Army colonel and leading researcher into the movement, who analyzed household resiliency data from FEMA. Ellis, who classifies a prepper as someone who could survive independently for 30 days, said the number has roughly doubled since 2017, which tracks with anecdotal reports from the prepper community. "The pandemic took things to a whole new level," said Roman Zarzewski, who runs a Texas-based survivalist store. "Demand surged so much in the first months of COVID that he had to hire 7 new employees just to answer emails. It was," he said, "kind of a customer service nightmare." Subsequent scares and disasters have drawn only more preppers. Carrie Smith, a Montanan in her mid-30s, said the 2023 sighting of a Chinese spy balloon over the U.S. made her realize she needed to take matters into my own hands. She and her husband have since bought 4 generators, three 55-gallon water drums, piles of freeze-dried food, and guns and tasers. And while the prepper community is growing fast, it's also rapidly diversifying. How is the movement changing? The archetypal prepper is white, rural, conservative male. But those who study, advise, and market to preppers report that liberals, city dwellers, and people of color are increasingly entering the fold, especially since President Trump's reelection. Shane Hobel, who teaches survival skills in upstate New York, says his clients now include not just soldier of fortune types, but women and Democrats, people who used to make fun of my school. While some liberal preppers cite climate change as their main driver and the fear that the government will be unable or unwilling to help, others worry that the U.S. could be engulfed by political violence. People understand that the world as we know it and counted on it being is beginning to cease to be, said Eric Schoenwelker, who writes the left-wing prepper newsletter When If. As those fears rise on the left and right, a booming industry has emerged to serve the prepping community. What is the industry worth? U.S. preppers spent $11 billion on gear in 2023, according to a Finder.com survey, and the market is still expanding. Preppers are snapping up water filtration systems, hand-cranked radios, manually powered grain mills, and pepper spray and other self-defense tools. Costco sells the $100 ReadyWide emergency food supply, a curated 150-serving bucket of freeze-dried and dehydrated foods. Business is up at Preppy, which offers emergency preparedness bags ranging from a $50 basic model to the $4,995 ultra-advanced bag, which includes a night vision scope, respirator masks, and luxe comfort such as Malin plus Getz toiletries. Ron Hubbard, CEO of Atlas Survival Shelters, says fears of unrest since 2020 have tripled sales of his bunkers, which run from $20,000 into the millions. They think civil war or revolution is coming, he said of his customers. Others sell space in survivalist communities. What do those communities look like? California-based Vivos Group is leasing space in what it calls the world's largest survival shelter community. 575 empty ex-Army concrete bunkers on South Dakota grasslands. In Kansas sits the Survival Condo, a former missile silo converted into a 15-story survival habitat with a movie theater, bar, swimming pool, rock climbing wall, and units that start at $1.2 million. Then there's Fortitude Ranch, a collection of 8 compounds around the country, founded by a retired U.S. Air Force colonel. Over 1,000 members have paid from about $2,000, which gets you shared bunk spaces, to $41,000 to become members, plus annual dues up to $1,550. The compounds are stocked with solar panels, food and medicine, farm animals and guard dogs. It's like the old saying goes, said a retired CIA officer who has bought in, when trouble is on the horizon, a wise man takes precautions. Will preppers' plans actually work? Some prep experts are skeptical, especially about how lone wolf survivalists would fare in an actual catastrophe. Schoenwelker cites the example of a lone prepper in a MAGA hat who breaks his leg, gets gangrene, and he's done. That's a month into the apocalypse, and all his guns did nothing for him. He and other lefty preppers say they offer a more realistic vision that emphasizes community and mutual support in the face of disaster. Of course, many dismiss preppers of any ideology as wild-eyed paranoics. But Michael Mills, a British social scientist who studies preppers, says amid rising worries of societal breakdown, a growing number of people are rethinking that view. There is a bigger question floating in the air, he said. Are preppers crazy, or is everyone else? Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. We'll start with equating protest with terrorism. If you publicly protest President Trump's authoritarian actions, said Andrew Egger, you're an Antifa radical who hates America. That's what Republican officials in the White House were saying this week prior to the second nationwide No Kings rally slated for October 18th. Millions of normie Americans participated in the first remarkably peaceful protest in hundreds of communities across the nation. But House Speaker Mike Johnson said that the No Kings protest will be a Hate America rally run by Antifa people. His top deputy, Representative Tom Emmer, sneered that the rally was the work of the Democrat terrorist wing. This unhinged rhetoric is a warning. When it comes to slowly tightening a lawless grip on a people, one of the authoritarian's most potent tools is guilt by association. To cast peaceful protesters who oppose Trump's regime as America-hating terrorists is not only to delegitimize them, but also unlock, in the view of the administration, a permission structure for the deployment of state violence. There's every reason to believe that Trump and his MAGA allies mean what they say and are laying the groundwork for an authoritarian crackdown on progressive organizations and large public protests. How e-bikes became so dangerous. E-bikes have evolved into e-motorcycles, and police and lawmakers aren't keeping up with the need to regulate them, said Jason Nark. The first generation of e-bikes were real bicycles with modest electric pedal assist that helped cyclists go up hills and ride for longer distances. But in the past 2 years, the market has become dominated by heavy, fat-tired vehicles with electric motors costing from $1,500 to $4,000. These are basically motorcycles with bike pedals, and they can go up to three times faster than legal e-bikes. Unlicensed teenagers without helmets and other daredevils are recklessly driving them up to 30 miles per hour on bike paths, hiking trails, and streets. Trauma doctors across the country say there's been explosive growth in serious injuries and even deaths from collisions between powerful e-cycles and regular cyclists, pedestrians, cars, and stationary objects. Lawmakers and police departments are scrambling to address the problem. But even in states that have adopted e-bike laws, they're rarely enforced. Unless that changes, powerful electric motorcycles will create havoc, terrorize pedestrians and cyclists, and send thousands of people to emergency rooms with broken bones and head trauma. This column comes from Poland. Standing up for the right to get drunk. Warsaw City councilors care about their constituents, but only the drunken ones, said Mateusz Zimmerman. Local lawmakers from the ruling Civic Platform Party have forced their own leader, Mayor Rafał Trzaskowski, to drop his proposed citywide ban on late-night alcohol sales. Yet Warsaw residents overwhelmingly support the proposal. They're sick of late-night brawls outside the liquor store and bachelor party revelers throwing up in the streets. It's not as if the city's leaders hadn't been fully appraised of the benefits of a ban. Over months of public debate, they heard the grim reports of drunk driving accidents, and they saw the studies that showed that dozens of other Polish cities have reaped tangible, positive results from their own bans. The lawmakers, surely influenced, if not bought off outright by pub owners and the alcohol lobby, chose to ignore all that. They recast the debate as one about economic freedom, as if the right to buy a bottle of vodka in the middle of the night were comparable to freedom of religion or freedom from torture. It's not. Addiction experts will tell you that most people buying booze in the wee hours are already tipsy. If, God forbid, you end up in one of Warsaw's emergency rooms soon and have to wait hours while the doctors attend to victims of a night of drinking, you'll know who to blame. The last word, our feature article, Ophelia's Descent. Ophelia Bockholt was a Wall Street analyst with a passion for helping people, said Shayla Dewan in the New York Times. How did she end up entangled in an AI-obsessed murder cult? A 10-year-old blue Toyota Prius was rocketing through northern Vermont on the afternoon of January 20th when a U.S. Border Patrol agent pulled it over for an immigration inspection. Law enforcement officers had been watching the two people inside the car for the better part of a week since a hotel employee reported that they were armed and dressed in tactical gear. Shortly before the Prius was stopped, officers watched them buy aluminum foil at a Walmart and wrap it around their phones. Now, on a stretch of highway flanked by snow-crusted ground and hardwood forest, one of the agents asked them to get out of the car. There seemed little explanation for what happened next. The driver of the Prius was a U.S. citizen with no criminal record. The passenger, a German national, had an H-1B visa, reserved for highly skilled workers. Items found in the car might have suggested a dark purpose, but were not illicit. A ballistic helmet, a night vision monocular, full-face respirators, and hollow-point ammunition. Yet without warning, according to an FBI affidavit, the driver drew a Glock pistol and opened fire. A Border Patrol agent fired back. The passenger also reached for a gun, according to an incident summary by the Border Patrol. The agent ordered the passenger to stop. The demand was ignored, and the agent shot at the passenger too, the summary said. The driver went down, struck in the arm and the leg. The passenger, hit twice in the chest, died at the scene. A Border Patrol agent took a bullet in the neck. He was rushed to the hospital, but did not survive. The driver was identified as Teresa Youngblood, 21, a University of Washington computer scientist student who had been reported missing by her parents 8 months earlier. Prosecutors have cited her associations with individuals suspected of violent acts, namely the shooting deaths of an older couple in the suburban Philadelphia home in 2023 and the fatal stabbing of an 82-year-old man who was to be the central witness in a trial in California. 8 months later, state and federal law enforcement officials are still trying to piece together a bizarre saga involving the deaths of six people in three states. Seven members of a group that was passionately vegan, mostly transgender, highly educated, and following a charismatic and confessional blogger who called herself Ziz, are now in jail, awaiting trial on charges ranging from trespass to murder. As the death count mounted, the story of what some news reports called a murder cult attracted national attention. The Zizians, as they became known, were a contentious faction within a tech-heavy subculture known as the rationalists, who are preoccupied with the dangers of artificial intelligence. The Zizians believed that veganism was essential to preventing an AI doomsday and that the rationalist establishment was hypocritical and covering up abuse and corruption. But the passenger in the Prius that January, they did not share the Zizian's most outlandish beliefs or outsider status. A transgender woman known as Ophelia Balkholt, she was a 28-year-old, highly paid analyst at a Manhattan trading firm, balancing a brimming social life with a devotion to helping vulnerable people. Her life was clearly falling apart. She was really stressed, and she didn't tell anyone about what was going on. And then she disappeared, said Astra Kolomitskaya, a close friend. So the story kind of cuts off there. Balkholt arrived in New York City in 2021 for a new job that friends said paid at least $500,000 a year. Brilliant and frolicsome, she plunged into the city's rationalist scene, usually accompanied by an entourage of other trans women. She socked away money to give to charity, living on a tenth of her income. Still, she was far from aesthetic. Her life was a heady mix of financial freedom, like-minded new friends, and the second puberty brought on by the hormone therapy. There were parties and polycules, experiments with injectable estrogen, and a transcranial magnetic stimulation machine that Balkholt and her friends used to activate parts of their brains. We were all young and kind of thought that we were invincible, capable, and special, and had a history of playing with fire and throwing conventional wisdom out the window, said Kolomitskaya, a mathematician who was Balkholt's roommate the summer before she vanished. Although Balkholt was vegan and trans, she did not aggressively proselytize about either, friend said. At work and to her family back home, she went by Felix. Born in Germany in 1996, Balkholt, still Felix to people from her past, was highly intelligent and socially inept, a friend recalled, but seemed unbothered by her lack of friends. Felix had principles, the friend said. He was the first one who as a kid went vegan. In 2014, she won a gold medal in a prestigious computer science competition, which landed her a scholarship at the University of Waterloo in Canada. At the beginning of her senior year, she donated $5,000 to purchase 1,100 mosquito nets. The nets would save approximately 1.4 lives, she posted on Facebook, along with a link to the underlying data. Balkholt was embracing the principles of what is known as effective altruism, which encourages people to make sure their effect on the world is a net positive, either by working for a good cause or taking a high-paying job in order to fund good causes. The effective altruism movement heavily overlaps with rationalism, a movement that, at its core, is an endeavor to think better. Rationalists, whose aspirations are evident in names like Less Wrong, a community forum, and Overcoming Bias, a New York City meetup group, try to minimize cognitive errors and constantly update their cached opinions based on new information. In part because of the community's devotion to open-mindedness, it attracts high numbers of trans and neurodivergent people. For the same reason, some participants flirt with extreme right ideology. Like the tech world more generally, the community is male-dominated and has been accused of encouraging norms of social and sexual freedom that provide cover for abusive behavior. In the summer of 2022, a blogger known as Silver and Ivory, who wrote about ethics and trans rights, dropped off the radar. Balkholt may not have ever met Silver, who lived in California and also went by Suri Dao in person, but she grew worried and decided to offer a bounty for information. Silver, it would be later become obvious, had joined the Zizians, who were living on a compound in Vallejo, California. The group's struggles were a stark contrast to Balkholt's thriving career and social life. Ziz, a 6'2" Alaskan with a marble complexion and rumpled blonde locks, had moved to the Bay Area in 2016 to join the rationalist community. As she chronicled in her blog, sincerely, she had little luck holding a job, finding stable housing, or persuading the rationalist establishment to try her ideas. A plan to convince people to live on boats called the Rationalist Fleet fell apart, leaving a decrepit tugboat listing in Half Moon Bay. Ziz became increasingly disillusioned and began trying to assemble a cabal of abnormally, intrinsically good people and turn them into jervious sociopaths who would, like those at the top of the organizational hierarchy in The Office, the sitcom co-written by Ricky Gervais, be ruthless in achieving their goals. She referred to herself as Darth Ziz, interim de facto leader of the vegan Sith, a reference to a Star Wars sect that uses the dark side of the Force. In 2019, Ziz and four friends were arrested after staging a protest at a rationalist gathering where they accused two of the movement's key institutions of betraying their mission to protect humanity from AI and of covering up pedophilia and sexual abuse. The resulting criminal case stalled in 2022 after the Coast Guard responded to a report that Ziz had gone overboard while sailing. A search and rescue effort proved fruitless, and on September 7th, an obituary appeared in the Fairbanks, Alaska Daily News Miner. Some rationalists denounced the Zizians as dangerous, noting, among other things, that two people who had engaged with their mental tech, including a method of trying to put half of their brains to sleep at a time, had killed themselves. But others in the community were sympathetic, finding it easy to believe the group's claim that it was the victim of mistreatment by law enforcement officers and that the rationalist establishment was hypocritical. Buchholz was in the latter camp. The group objects to the name Zizians, saying Ziz is not its leader. She frequently discussed the Zizians, but as far as Kolomatsky knew, the subject was little more than a conjectural pastime. We're like, the Zizians are dropping like flies. Why don't we prevent them from dying, she recalled. It's a curiosity. It's a very fun thing to talk about every week. Still, Buchholz was invested. She told a friend, according to a screenshot of a Discord chat, that based on their convictions, you would have predicted that they'd become respected members of the rationalist community instead of people just talk about how they don't want to hear anything about cults when I bring up stuff related to them. She later wrote that she was pretty stressed once I got news that Ziz is allegedly dead. By November, two members of the Zizians, including Silver, were arrested after an attack on their landlord, who was stabbed multiple times and impaled with a sword. During the struggle, he shot and killed another Zizian, whom Buchholz had interacted with online, in what authorities said was self-defense. And Ziz, it turned out, was not dead. A person fitting her description was also at the scene and was taken to a hospital by police. Buchholz told a friend she was skeptical of law enforcement's account of the episode and implied she had a connection with this group. If your concern is that they're dangerous to be around because they are being targeted, she wrote in a Discord chat, that also applies to me. Then on New Year's Eve, the parents of another of Ziz's friends, Michael Zatko, were shot in the head in their home in Chester Heights, Pennsylvania. The case remains unsolved. But authorities have identified Zatko, who had written that her parents had verbally abused her, as a person of interest. When police found Zatko, Ziz, and a man named Daniel Blank in a hotel a couple of weeks after their deaths, they arrested them for obstruction of justice. Buchholz became secretive about her relationship to the Zizians. At this point, I don't feel like telling you whether I'm friends with Ziz or not, she wrote in a Discord chat. But I do want to note that I've never said I was friends with Ziz. In June 2023, Ziz was released from jail in Pennsylvania. Around that time, Baucholtz's friends noticed a distinct change in her behavior. She started having frequent secretive phone calls, according to Kolomatsky. She stopped going to work and began to leave town every weekend, but did not say where she was going. In November, Baucholtz disappeared from the New York area entirely and stopped responding to messages. Unbeknownst to her friends, she and some Zizians had rented two Airbnbs in a secluded neighborhood in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. They rode bicycles and had a style of dressing that Paul Lascara, a neighbor, described as Sith Lord Goth. In the wee hours of February 13, 2024, a Prius registered to Baucholtz was captured on license plate cameras driving north through New York State toward Vermont, where Zajko had previously lived, according to a court filing. That day and the next, Zajko bought four handguns, the filing says. In the border shootout almost a year later, the driver of the Prius, Youngblood, fired one of those guns, authorities said. Baucholtz, they said, reached for another. The Zizians were exactly what Baucholtz had long been on the lookout for, people who needed saving. She had the resources to fund an underground life. She and Youngblood had gone to Vermont to look at an off-the-grid property for sale. She believed the Zizians could not get a fair hearing, either by the rationalist community or by the courts. She was a crack mathematician who erred in her most consequential calculation of risk. You can give the people the benefit of the doubt, and you can have it not bite you for the longest time, until it does. A version of this story first appeared in the New York Times. One of the obituaries, the screen icon who ignored conventions, Diane Keaton, 1946 to 2025. Diane Keaton's natural acting style and idiosyncratic fashion sense upended Hollywood's cliches of movie star glamour. Her best roles highlighted her quirky charm or her passionate intensity, and she could bounce between self-deprecation and easy self-confidence. A widely acclaimed actress, she earned an Oscar for her role in Woody Allen's Annie Hall, as well as nominations for Reds, Marvin's Room, 1996, and Something's Gotta Give, 2003. She made just as indelible a mark on the culture through her menswear-inspired style. Keaton lived in hats and ties, never bearing much skin, and even accepted her Oscar wearing two skirts, a tie over a white shirt, and socks with her heels. In career, appearance, and personal life, she defied cultural norms. "It's an unconventional life, it's true," she often said. "I just worked my way into the life that I have because I had a goal, and it was very simple. I wanted to be in the movies." Born Diane Hall in Los Angeles, she dropped out of community college at 19 to study acting in New York and adopted her mother's maiden name. At 25, she made her Broadway debut in 1968's Hair, but refused to appear nude in the final scene. Her next job, Allen's 1969 play, Play It Again, Sam, launched a relationship with a director. They would date for 3 years and earned her a Tony nomination. But a film career was always Keaton's goal, said the New York Times, and she appeared in her first movie, Lovers and Strangers, in 1970. She remained close with Allen, starring in many of his films and defending him against the accusation that he had molested his daughter Dylan. In acting terms, Keaton proved that a woman could have it all, said The Guardian, excelling in classic dramas like the Godfather series and beloved comedies like The First Wives Club, 1996, and Father of the Bride, 1991. Always stubbornly herself, Keaton came to define the modern independent woman for a generation with their own incomes, opinions, and neuroses, said the Times UK. While she dated Warren Beatty and spent years with Al Pacino, she never married, but in her 50s adopted two kids. She began directing in 1987 and later took up writing, publishing over a dozen books on everything from architecture to fashion. Getting older hasn't made me wiser, she said in 2019. I don't know anything, and I haven't learned. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. Have time for one of those articles. This one is Religion, Thiel's Antichrist Obsession. Tech billionaire Peter Thiel wants to alert the world to an overlooked danger, said Natasha Tiku in the Washington Post, the coming of the Antichrist. In a recent series of off-the-record lectures delivered in San Francisco to sold-out crowds, the venture capitalist and GOP megadonor warned that critics of technology, artificial intelligence, and financial innovation are the legionaries of the Antichrist, who could usher in the destruction of America and an era of global totalitarian rule. The modern version of the biblical Antichrist would be a Luddite who wants to stop all science. It's someone like Greta or Eliezer, he said, referring to the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg and AI researcher Eliezer Yudkowsky, who wants to prevent machines from achieving human-level intelligence. By calling for stricter global regulations, he claimed, these activists could help create a singular world government that the Antichrist would then use to control humanity. Thiel is a devout Christian and longtime libertarian. Still, his words were striking in their effort to cast resisting oversight of technology development as a religious battle. The Antichrist has long haunted American politics, said Matthew Avery Sutton in The Guardian. A protean figure cobbled together from obscure biblical passages, the demonic supervillain typically grabs the popular imagination during times of social disruption and geopolitical dread. Over the years, the tag has been affixed to New Deal bureaucrats, Hitler, communists, and Saddam Hussein, but its familiarity makes it no less dangerous. Once you cast your opponents as satanic agents, compromise becomes complicity and violence begins to look sanctifying. As an Episcopal priest, I find Thiel's warnings heretical, said Kevin Deal in the San Francisco Standard. In the Bible, the Antichrist represents a foil to Christ, not a tool to sow fear or division. Thiel is cynically weaponizing the language of faith to serve his own ends. Thiel seems like someone desperately trying to disidentify from his own vast power, said Adrian Daub in The Guardian. This is a man who, with his fellow Silicon Valley freaks, mentored Vice President J.D. Vance and helped return to the White House an unfit president determined to remake society and the world. The PayPal and Palantir co-founder funds the companies that harness your data and determine who gets doxxed, deported, drone struck. And he continues to champion the development of AI, despite also admitting that the technology just might kill us all. If Thiel truly wants to identify the shadowy forces that could end humanity, perhaps he should put down the Book of Revelation and take a look in the mirror. And we'll wrap up with a few of the short notes. In President Trump's first 200 days, only 2% of the 98 Senate-confirmed appointees to top leadership roles were black. Over that same period, black officials accounted for 21% appointees under President Biden, 13% under President Obama, and 8% under President George W. Bush. The U.S. has confirmed at least 1,563 measles cases this year, the highest annual number in more than three decades. The vast majority of cases were in unvaccinated people, and roughly a quarter were in children under five. About one in eight cases resulted in hospitalization. Nearly a quarter of the FBI's roughly 13,000 agents have been reassigned to immigration enforcement, including more than 40% of agents in the country's largest field offices, a sharp shift in law enforcement priorities under President Trump. Agents were pulled from duties related to terrorism, drug trafficking, counterintelligence, and more. 37 inmates whose death sentences were commuted last year by President Biden have been targeted for harsh treatment by the Trump administration. Plans to transfer most of the inmates to mainline prisons were canceled, and they were instead moved to maximum security facility in Colorado, where inmates typically spend 23 hours a day alone in their cell. I guess we've got time for two quotes. The first comes from Martin Luther King, Jr. "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny." Jane Goodall says, "Here we are, the most clever species ever to have lived. So how is it we can destroy the only planet we have?" And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.